Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your purposeful pop of music news and criticism. I am your guest host, Karen Gans. John Caramonica is on vacation, so it is I, his editor, stepping in to woman the podcast this week, and I am pleased to welcome Lindsay Zolads. Hello there.
Hi.
And we are going to be talking about something that many listeners have been tweeting at us, asking us to talk about. Lady Gaga and Katy Perry, together again on the podcast. As most of you know, both of them have put out albums in the past few months. Lady Gaga, Chromatica, Katy Perry, Smile. And when you start digging into these two, they actually have a lot more in common than I realized career-wise. So this is the sixth album for both of them. They are 34 and 35 years old, respectively, starting with Lady Gaga. Both of these albums have been seen as return to form records, you know, harkening back to the sounds of their past. Both of them are coming out of periods of depression that they have said were connected directly to their success. They're both coming off albums that were received slightly less well critically last time. Well, that might just be my Joanne bias, but we'll get there eventually.
We will.
But on both of those albums, I know you love that album, Lindsay. Both of those albums were trying to do something very specific, and you know, they succeeded and failed in some ways. In the interim between those albums, both of them paused to do some work in another medium. Lady Gaga, obviously, A Star is Born. Katy Perry became very involved with American Idol, where she is a judge slash mentor. I think both of these stars see themselves as therapeutic to their audience in some ways. They, you know, they use the language of aiding fans in therapy in their conversations. Both of them had timing issues this time with the release of their albums related to the two big storylines that have been happening the past 6 months, the pandemic and the protests against racial injustice. So let us get right in there. That is my setup where I've been musing about these two records. Lindsay, you worked on our reviews for both of these. If we were just going to sort of go over your general takes on both of them, what would you say?
Well, first of all, that was a lot of connection. I was impressed at what you just did there.
Oh, thank you.
I was like the Always Sunny in Philadelphia meme with like all the things on the bulletin board connected. That's what I was seeing.
I'm tracking a mass murderer via the relationships between Lady Gaga and Katy Perry.
It just clicked listening to these two albums together. But no, I think you're right. I think there are really striking similarities that kind of we'll be talking about the larger arc of these two artists' careers and where one sits as a pop star in her mid-30s in 2020. What does that look like right now in the larger scope of things? And I think they're both sort of trying to figure that out in their own ways. I do really enjoy Chromatica. I think it's a record that has grown on me from the time that we did a roundtable review of it. I think a lot of us were pretty lukewarm on it, like first listen, but it has been something that I find myself listening to a lot. I still have the same fundamental problem with it, which is that I think the final third of it just totally falls apart for me. And the Elton John song, I just like cannot deal with.
I'm glad we're on the same page there because I think that people have mixed opinions of that. Just to recap for listeners, Chromatica, the big single is Rain on Me with featuring Ariana Grande, which Lady Gaga performed live. No, but on the VMAs this
live-ish.
Weekend.
Live-ish.
You wrote about that too. You had a lot of affection for her performance. I thought maybe we could actually detour there for a moment.
It was the Gaga show, the VMAs this year. And as I wrote, I think the VMAs is often a show where the most famous person to show up gets the sort of lavish treatment, at least like the latter day VMAs. So Gaga, she won, I think, 4 awards televised. She did this like 10-minute medley Chromatica performance that in a lot of ways felt like what she wanted to do on the tour for this record that now can't happen on the timeline that it was initially supposed to happen on. So I felt like it kind of was the Chromatica experience in miniature.
Totally. And something you wrote that I really appreciated was, you know, the VMAs are basically the fakest award show of the music award shows. Well, actually, maybe the American Music Awards are a little bit faker. You know, the criteria for winning is whatever. But Lady Gaga threw herself into this with so much verve and appreciation that she made you care about it. Even in the back of my mind, it kept flickering the idea, this is ludicrous. They made up a sort of icon award for her called the Tricon Award, which I still don't understand what that means. But she really took this as an opportunity. She was just like, you know what? I'm trying to promote this album. I can't be on tour. There's not much I can do. If I could just take over the show in an endearing and, you know, accomplished manner. And she did it. I thought it was really awesome.
If you compare sort of the VMA speech that we saw with the, you know, the read of her when she first came out, which was this very enigmatic, sort of ironic, Warholian celebrity who was playing around a lot with ideas about fame and femininity too, all sorts of, you know, wacky costumes and imagery. And there was a sense of irony about her. And I think that what has happened over time, and I think that's this has kind of always been at her core, but it's just become more to the forefront as she's gotten older and expanded into these new realms of celebrity, is she's become one of our most sincere and earnest pop stars and celebrities. And whether she's winning a Golden Globe as she did for American Horror Story and giving this really just reverent speech that I think surprised some people, and segue that into the Star is Born era of her just achieving these accolades, being really grateful, really sincere, really happy to be there. That was kind of the Gaga that we saw as now in like pop star mode, but accepting these VMAs as though it was like another Oscar or something.
Totally.
And I think she has over time, she's incredibly sincere and everything seems to mean a lot to her and to be another step on this journey, which I think is kind of surprising when you look at the way, you know, she sort of existed when she first came out.
I totally agree with you. And I think the most interesting pivot point here would be the moment between Art Pop and Joanne. Because that seems to be where everything changed. I mean, Art Pop was basically like, she was pushing it as far as she possibly could. What can I get away with? And I think that everybody kind of put the brakes on her on that album. You know, there are definitely, I don't know where you land on Art Pop. I think there are like brilliant moments on it, but it is such a disaster to me. I mean, it's a good disaster because it's fun to talk about. And then you flip to Joanne, where she has suddenly decided that she has to be the most sincere possible. She has to be so sincere that there needs to be a narrative plucked from her life that she can rely on as an explanation for why she's made this decision. And she chooses an aunt that she was close to, right? Was Joanne her aunt, I believe?
Yeah.
Who she was named after, who was sick and she was a victim of a sexual assault. And the thing that irked me about Joanne, which I discussed on the Taylor Swift podcast, that irked me about Folklore, was the idea that in order to communicate sincere ideas that you suddenly have to switch to an acoustic guitar and a certain mode of singing to be authentic. That kind of irked me. Let's listen to one of the sincere Joanne tracks. In fact, let's listen to this title track, Joanne.
Take my hand, stay Joanne, heaven's not ready for you. Every part of my aching heart needs you more than the angels do. Girl, where do you think you're going?
I think my opinion of Joanne is fairly well known, that I am not a huge fan. But Lindsay, I know that you are a fan of the record, and I would love for you to spend a few moments convincing me that I'm wrong. I won't agree with you, but we can try.
Okay. Full disclosure first, I did once have my birthday party at Joanne Trattoria, the restaurant that Lady Gaga's parents own. Did not get to meet them or anything, but that's where I stand on the world of Joanne.
I'm interested in the restaurant. I'm more interested in the restaurant than the album.
It was pretty good. It was pretty good. I got it. It got good reviews from everyone there. We got a nice little private room in the back. It was great. Thanks, Joanne. But I think you might be overstating my love of this record a little bit. I don't think it's certainly not my favorite Gaga record. And I think that the things that I like about it are sort of not the first thing that one thinks about when talking about Joanne, which is, again, the really kind of serious acoustic side of Gaga and the pink cowboy hat and this sort of family history woven through. I really like the back half of that record, where there are just a few songs where she's taking chances but working with different writers and producers. I love the Father John Misty song Come to Mama on that record, and the duet with Florence Welch and Grigio Girls. Come on, love it. It's my jam.
Angel Down is in between there.
Yes, which I even enjoy Angel Down. I think like side B of Joanne for me is her kind of flexing these other muscles that, again, I do now in the context of her discography. That record feels more like a lead up to the Star is Born soundtrack, which I think is like a better record and has better serious Gaga songs on it. And which I know it's not like traditionally considered. It's a Bradley Cooper record, you could say. No.
Featuring Lady Gaga, yeah.
But I think Joanne makes more sense in the hindsight of that. And I think it's aged better maybe for me in the context of Star is Born coming afterwards and actually being good and sort of a showcase for another side of her talents. But while Art Pop is a disaster in some ways, it's kind of a disaster that I love. I can't say I like am listening to it all the time in 2020, but there's a few songs on there that I think are amazing. And even the excessive, ridiculous parts of it are a part of Gaga that I do really enjoy, which is just, there's this over the top, insane nature of her that I think was not getting the outlet maybe in the Joanne era. So I think like coming up to Chromatica, it feels a little bit of both, because we can talk about how this record, even as much as I've listened to it now, I'm still not over just like, a lot of these songs are really sad. And they're dance songs. There's a driving beat throughout like pretty much everything on this record, even the more lower tempo songs. But she's really, I think, finding a way to not have that dichotomy so much between like serious sounding song and serious subject. These are like songs that sound fun, but they're about depression or a failing relationship or her feeling misunderstood within the context of her fame that feels different and somehow more personal than I think something that would be on like The Fame or Fame Monster.
Yeah, or reclaiming her power after a sexual assault, which is what Free Woman is about, which is a song that has really grown on me since the time it came out. Actually, let's listen to that for a moment. I say that I want it, be free. Don't fight it, but if I'm gonna go for it, I'll remember that. I say that I want it, be free. Don't fight it, but if I'm gonna go for it, I'll remember that. I'm not nothing without a steady hand. I'm not nothing. I like Chromatica a lot more now than I did when we reviewed it. I've been able to spend a bit more time with it. I think Alice is really strong. Stupid Love is a much stronger single than I gave it credit for at the time. But yeah, Free Woman is definitely stepping up there for me, along with Enigma. Now, but something that I cannot stand that you actually like, so let's talk about it, are the Chromatica 1, 2, and 3 orchestral bits that are peppered throughout the album. To me, they are superfluous, although I understand the ecstasy of the last few seconds of Chromatica 2 into 911, which we can listen to after we discuss it a little bit. But I think you see these three moments as having a bit more merit than I do. So I wanted to ask you about it.
I was with you in the beginning, when we first sort, I don't remember if this made it into the roundtable or not, but I could not get behind these interstitials, which I will say are courtesy of the artist Morgan Kibbe, who's also a member of M83.
And is very cool. Yes, I have enjoyed her work in the past for sure.
Yes, so good for her to be on a Gaga record. I also want to shout out my friend James, who was the first person I know the day Chromatica came out to be like, but I love the interstitials. And I was like, really? And then over time, what I did not like at the beginning was the sense of grandeur and the kind of, we're dividing this record into three chapters. That felt too bombastic to me, too like reminiscent of the art pop era or something, too taking itself too seriously. But I think that this record has, in a way that the Katy Perry record maybe is not, which we can talk about later, just like the Chromatica internet has become very endearing and like a thing to me. And it's kind of, this record has produced like some memes within the pop musical world that I think like add to its charm somehow. And one of them is the Chromatica 2 into 911 meme of just this moment of like incredible drama and transition. I don't think it's like a TikTok thing. I think like most people enjoying this record are like maybe too old to be on TikTok, which I don't know if that's like a hot take either. But
that's another thing we definitely need to talk about. Yeah.
It's a meme in the traditional like TikTok cut where it goes from this, you know, orchestral flourish to the really hard driving electro beat of 911. And, you know, people have made all sorts of memes. In the VMAs, she kind of nodded to that, I think, with an understanding that, you know, this is not something that she like released this song as a single or something. This was something that the internet took hold of. And I think in her own knowing way is kind of acknowledging now, but it's a very wholesome meme.
Okay, well, we have to listen to it so people know what we're talking about. So
yeah,
let's hear that transition from Chromatica 2 into 911. Now, part of what irked me about Chromatica that I'm getting over now was sort of like the narrative around it that Lady Gaga was constructing about being on another planet, escaping, healing. To me, the music didn't fully bear it out. It seemed like a lot of promise that wasn't completely realized on the record. But there are moments, I think, where we sort of get there. Enigma is one of them. Enigma also is the name of her Vegas residency, which involves like a very, very long, drawn-out narrative about like an AI called Enigma that comes to show her who she is. I don't know if any of you have seen this. I saw a version of it. It's very confusing. Part of my Lady Gaga gripe, and people think that I'm very hard on Lady Gaga. I am hard on Lady Gaga because she is one of the most talented artists of our generation, and she made two of the best albums of the past 20 years, Fame Monster and Born This Way. So this is why I'm hard on Lady Gaga. I don't hate her. People on the internet like to point out that I like Madonna and therefore I'm in opposition. I have to hate Lady Gaga. I love Lady Gaga. I want her to succeed, but I feel like a lot of these things are distraction, and a lot of the way she chooses to perform these things live just sort of distracts from the actual talent that she has. It's a lot of speechifying, a lot of messaging, and that it goes on for a very long time. I don't know. These are my overall why I'm critical of Chromatica thoughts. Earlier, we were talking about Rain On Me, which is what we heard at the top of the podcast, which was the centerpiece of Gaga's VMA's performance this weekend, which is a collaboration with Ariana Grande, which was a very interesting collaboration. We talked about the Elton John song, which I think we both think is not very successful, but there is another very cool collaboration on the album, which is with Blackpink, the K-pop group. What do you think about that one, Sour Candy? It's one of my favorites.
I like it. It's not one of my faves, I would say, but it's that stretch of the record. I think the second third between Chromatica 2 and Chromatica 3 is kind of my favorite run on the record, and just feels a little darker and more hard driving than what the singles were. But I do think it's interesting to look at like the collaborators that she is working with on this record, with the exception of Elton John, who I think we're just, the less we can say about that song, the better. But I think that in a lot of ways, this record is Gaga being kind of conscious about stepping into this role as like an elder stateswoman of pop music right now. And even though, you know, she's only 34, but in pop music years, that is, especially for women, there's kind of this idea that she's has to mature in some way now. So I think I see the collaborations on the first two pieces of this record being her kind of like looking forward and looking to like a younger generation of pop stars. Not that Ariana Grande is like so much younger than her, but enough that, you know, I think the duet has this sort of like Gaga taking her under her wing in a way and kind of welcoming her into this fold. It's a duet between them, but it's a Lady Gaga song that Ariana Grande is appearing on. And I think the way that it was performed at the VMAs really underscored that. I also want to shout out the little trumpet noise in the beginning of Rain On Me, that burp, 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 burp. That's like my favorite thing.
It's interesting. I have a slightly different take on Rain On Me, where I feel like it's definitely a Gaga song, but I kind of feel like Ariana steals the show and that Gaga was leaning on her so much during the promotional process that it actually got to be curious, you know, at a certain point to me. I mean, Ariana has a huge social following and she has like a far more relaxed way of speaking directly to her fans that Gaga used to have. There was some sort of shift in the past few years where Lady Gaga's social media used to be just very pure. And then it kind of flipped into like, I don't know, got a little more promotional. And then it got I feel very detached from her in a way. Where like the kind of relationships that younger artists are forging with their fans on social media, it's obviously critical to all their success. That's something that I feel like Gaga did so successfully early on, and that she was kind of drafting off of Ariana a little bit during this whole cycle. I mean, they've been playing up their friendship significantly. It was a huge part of her acceptance speeches and stuff. It's just, I felt like that was interesting. But what you're saying about Lady Gaga's sort of transition moment, sort of reckoning with the idea that she's becoming a little bit of an elder statesman in the industry. That's definitely where Katy Perry has been, I think, for the last two records, maybe. So if we could segue a little bit into talking about Smile. Smile, following Witness from 2017, which was the album where the first single was Chained to the Rhythm, which I loved so much. In fact, let's just listen to it for a few seconds to remind ourselves of a moment we relished, or I relished. Are we crazy?
This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Okay, so when this song came out, I was actually really blown away. I thought the song was great. I thought the message was very interesting. And that the rhetoric around it, purposeful pop, that Katy Perry was going to be looking for something to wed the music to something a little bit deeper. I was totally there for it. And then she threw us a complete curveball with the next couple of singles. Bon Appetit, which was like, whoa, where are we going now? With Migos guesting on it. And Swish Swish, which I really loved, which actually we meant to talk about how Swish Swish and Sour Candy are kind of involving the same beat, which I really actually enjoyed. What was your take on Witness? I profiled Katy Perry on that album, so I have a lot to say about it, but I would love to hear you.
Well, I think it's one of those records that the idea of Witness, as much in the sense that art pop, I think, became this idea of a flop, of like a big, bombastic, expensive flop, that the record itself, what both of those records, when you actually go back and listen to them, I think they're both much more interesting than the overall like meme of what Witness is within the pop world and what it represents is, which is, again, just kind of this big, flashy, expensive disaster. And I think both Gaga and Katy Perry, the teams behind them and the amount of work that goes into a record of the scale at which they put records out, they're never going to just release something where there's no redeeming qualities whatsoever. And so I think there are interesting moments on both of those records. I do think more than art pop, Witness, I want to make the case for it just to be contrarian, but I really don't think that I can. It's like, I want it to be sort of secretly good and there to be a few songs and be like, everyone got it wrong. But I think in, you know, in revisiting it, in writing about this new record, I still don't think it's very good. There are a couple songs that I also am a Swish Swish fan. And I think I actually like Swish Swish better than Sour Candy. Another one in the basket. I think that one kind of got short shrift in the, you know, there are some really terrible singles on the record too, but I think that one got lumped in there sort of unfairly. But I think it was just, it represented this moment where the narrative really got away from her. And that's been her greater problem. And it was, you know, I think she was in the right place at the right time with the right people around her for so long. And then things changed very suddenly, both in the culture and in the country and in what makes pop music successful. And she kind of, you know, was cashing in on all those things for so many years with Teenage Dream and Prism and kind of riding this wave of just everything she was doing was turning to gold. And then the backlash hit just as hard. And
I think Witness was like a really purposeful moment of...
Purposeful.
Yes, I know. Now that word is just going to come up every second. But like a creative shift of, you know, seizing control after having worked with Dr. Luke and his team for so long. You know, she had the creative reins. She attempted to work with a lot of smaller songwriters and producers. And I think, you know, when you're writing about a record or interviewing someone, you get a little Stockholm syndromed into, you're living with it and experiencing it so much. So I think I did like it better at the time than I do now. Now that I've lived with it a little bit longer, I went back and I was like, I think I remember liking some of these songs. I felt bad about the way it landed because I felt like, I mean, again, these are things that Katy and Gaga both said impacted the making of their new albums. It's like the fame narrative and the celebrity narrative that's constructed around them that is sometimes not even that directly connected to the music. You know, I think it was just a delicious idea to people that Katy Perry, the unending success, had suddenly had a stumble. And people seized on that, and she didn't help herself with the narrative she constructed around it and the press cycle where she seemed, you know, to be preaching, you know, the sort of the global concern gospel, but she was speaking it in such a manner that it really just seemed sort of like a self-serving moment. And these things were in such, you know, juxtaposition, they were just butting against each other that she ended up looking not so great when it came out. I can't even imagine that press cycle through a 2020 prism. No pun intended, because it would just be so unwelcome. It probably would have just shut down immediately. But we've discussed this, and you discussed this in one of a playlist recap write-up of the song Smile, which I actually really like. I don't mind hearing it 10,000 times a day on Target commercials because I think it's a successful song. Yeah, I'm faithful. Scratch that, baby, I'm faithful. Gotta say it's really been a while, but now I got back that smile. I'm so faithful. Scratch that, baby, I'm faithful. Now you see me shine from a mile. Finally got back that smile. Every day, Groundhog Day. People were offended by the idea of something even called Smile, like that Katy Perry would be as audacious as to come out with an album right now that wasn't just about the moment. I mean, obviously this album was made before the moment and there's not much she could do about it. You pointed out that she's had some poor timing in the past too. It just sort of seems to be like a Katy Perry thing.
In talking about Katy Perry, again, this overall idea of like the narrative projected onto her has become so overwhelming. And I think at least with Smile, like, I want to push back on that a little bit because, like, of course Katy Perry is allowed to release an album called Smile in Twitter. Like, I don't care. I don't want to hear her, like, pandemic album. I want to hear, like, some feel-good songs that, you know, she can dress in a clown outfit. I don't care. It's cute, whatever.
You know, that part I had pushed back against, but yes, go on.
She can do, you know,
I mean,
whatever.
She created plenty of memes. I've been getting texts of her in different clown outfits from, like, everybody I know for the past 6 weeks, but go on.
I think in some ways, like, the witness narrative took hold so thoroughly and so kind of the idea that I think I compared her in the review to being, like, the left shark out of step with the culture and that she can't get back in. And I think we're maybe overstating it at this point of like, at what point does the narrative take away from actually considering the album that is here in front of us? And I certainly don't think Smile is the disaster that Witness was, but it also, I think it's trying to do much less and kind of understanding that we don't need to ask the world of a big expensive pop record. It can just be fun and have some tunes that make us feel a little bit better about the world. I think in retrospect too, as I was revisiting Witness for this piece, it does feel of a piece with Taylor Swift's reputation, another record that came out in 2017. I think like several years from now, someone, maybe I'll do it if no one else will, but there is a piece to be written about like the pop music of 2017 and how it was received in the first year of the Trump era, what people were expecting, what they weren't. It seemed like we suddenly were like wanting pop stars to both address the moment and not, or do it in some particular way. And I think both of those records, the way they were interpreted was very contingent upon what was going on in the world and just how crazy everything felt and how what we were asking out of like every cultural product, which I think she and Taylor, now that they're friends again, do, we love it, have both kind of in their own ways and to varying degrees of commercial success, at least, kind of recalibrated what people wanted from them and realized that they did not need to be making these grand, like multi-platform saving the world statements. Like, we kind of just want them to make good music and that's it. But there was this moment that I think she got more stuck in than Taylor Swift did of, you know, becoming this out of touch pop person who couldn't really address what was going on in the world, but was trying to and ended up making everything about herself.
I mean, that kind of describes reputation. Although, you know, the podcast stands reputation. We love that album here. And I feel like we did love it a lot when it came out. We still love it now. But yes, it is an album that sort of purports to be about larger things, but is ultimately about its artist. But I mean, we're also talking about the three of the biggest personalities and pop stars that there are, which is why I was going to bring up Taylor after. But now that since we brought it up, let's just go there now. That like the most, one of the most interesting things to me about 2020 is that Lady Gaga makes a return to form record of sorts. Katy Perry makes a return to form record of sorts. And Taylor Swift takes herself out of the narrative entirely. She did not have her album pre-made before the pandemic. You know, she sat down as it started and decided to make an album that is both like reflective of like where she is emotionally, but also sort of where the world is, and is the most successful of all of them. I have been intrigued by that. I mean, this is what one of Taylor's most successful albums ever. It just spent its fifth consecutive week at number one. Katy Perry is not going to open at number one. I'm not really sure where in the top 10 she's going to open. Lady Gaga's album came out the week that protests over George Floyd's death were really picking up, and it felt impossible to want to celebrate anything or want to listen to something like pop music. Lady Gaga has not had an opportunity really to promote the album because I think she wisely stepped back and she didn't want to be talking about it at a moment where that was not the subject that everybody was concerned with. And then obviously she can't tour to support it either. So Chromatica's kind of fallen into a little bit of a black hole. Walking up into both of these records, my thinking was if they were complete bombs or totally disastrous, I was not convinced that both of these stars were really going to be able to get an opportunity like this again, you know, to have like a giant star turn record, like that their careers would have turned the corner. And I think both Chromatica and Smile are solid enough that they set them up where I think they're both obviously going to make next records. I'm curious to see where they go. And it'll be just interesting to see if they lean further into this or if looking at something like what Taylor Swift has done, you know, there are other modes for them at the moment. Taylor Swift actually made like an extremely mature album for an artist who is earlier in her career than they are. Taylor sort of shined a light on a different model. You know, like she really did go small in a way that both of these records went big. And ultimately that's kind of where the culture ended up being right now. And that's partially to me why the album is so successful.
If you're at all invested in the Katy Perry narrative, which I know you, Karen, are also a fan of Katy Perry, Part of Me, great music documentary of our age, there is always this undercurrent in the Katy Perry story that the music she was making was, or at least the music she was making at her most successful in the Teenage Dream era, was not necessarily like the music that she grew up dreaming of making. You know, she started out as Katie Hudson, this sort of pop gospel Christian rock singer, had, you know, several different rebrands into a kind of like Warped Tour personality, pop punk kind of thing. And then finally it was the hyper poppy Dr. Luke Americana sound that really stuck for her. But there's always, if you go back and read interviews with her from like the height of her fame, you know, she was always talking about like wanting to make an Alanis Morissette record or wanting to make an acoustic record or something. And kind of there was this, you know, and I think there's a lot of pop stars and artists, especially who are also songwriters who kind of have that desire of just like, there's more inside of me than these hits, but these hits are what are kind of making my career go forward at this point. So she was always kind of talking about wanting to do something a little bit smaller and more intimate. And I agree with you, Karen, that I think Folklore, the Taylor Swift record, is, I'm very curious to see the ripple effects of that in the careers of artists who are not Taylor Swift. And if they're kind of seeing that doing something more intimate, a little bit left field, but also more personal, if that's maybe not as much of a commercial risk as, you know, Katy Perry trying to make a song 6 albums into her career that's going to be a catchy pop radio hit anymore, which, you know, this record has not succeeded in that sense. And I think what keeps it from being a really good record to me, or even like a good pop record, is that it does feel torn between those two impulses of there's a few smaller, more personal and intimate songs. The closing track, What Makes a Woman, is like, it's like a country song kind of. I was very surprised by that track. It's really subdued and feels more mature for her. But then there are still these really flashy songs with expensively cleared samples and references to Drake songs and stuff that feel like they're pandering to radio right now. And I feel like it's just caught between those two stages of her career. And she could go in either way, like follow either one of those paths moving forward. But she has always expressed this desire to make a record that maybe wouldn't be as commercially successful, but would be more true to Katie Hudson. herself.
I totally agree. I mean, this album is, the first part of it is far more like electro-poppy than you actually, you know, when you start listening to the production, it's actually way more in that direction than I thought at first. But I also, going back to the Taylor thing, I mean, I think there's a real question of audience here. You know, like, this seems like a Katy Perry album that's like targeted at the Katy Perry audience, which is now an aging audience of people probably in their, I'm going to say 20s, 30s, 40s. And the Lady Gaga album also seems like, you know, laser targeted at her core. But the thing about the Taylor album that maybe is why it's so successful is that it's brought in whole other audiences that might not have considered listening to a Taylor album, partially because of its sound and partially because of the collaborators, Aaron Dessner from The National, Bon Iver's Justin Vernon. And I think that it introduced the idea of listening to Taylor Swift to people who might not have considered it. And this is actually a big question about Lady Gaga and Katy Perry. When we're talking about them, they're not old. Obviously, they're in their mid-30s. But when you're looking at a pop universe that's kind of ruled now by Billie Eilish's of the world, and truly by hip-hop stars who are also a lot younger, you know, they're relatively older. Who is this music aimed for?
I will say I felt their pain a little bit, because in giving a sort of lukewarm review to the Katy Perry record, I got called boomer on the internet by a lot of her fans. They were, which I just want to state for the record, I'm not a boomer.
You were at least 10 years younger than I am, so, and I am not a boomer either, so we're both safe
in
that.
I am several years younger than Katy Perry, but not by much, so... but I think there is this narrative of that pop music somehow is like that this type of music is for the young, and that anyone over like X age cannot possibly understand it, which is of course a lie and like a fallacy. But as you know, what happens, I guess, when these artists become the age when people are like, if someone can call me a boomer and I'm a little bit younger than Katy Perry, like, what does that make her? And I think to varying degrees, both of these artists are sort of trying to navigate that impasse in their career. And I think Gaga, you know, so far has been more successful just because, you know, she's an old soul. She made a record with Tony Bennett already, like in her early 30s, and has kind of, you know, can appeal to this incredibly broad audience, you know, beyond just music, but within her acting career now too. I think Katy, I mean, I don't know what her ultimate aspirations are, if, you know, it seems like at the very least with this record, we should say that she just gave birth to her daughter, Daisy Bloom. Congrats to them both. But I think in the way that she was presenting this record too, she, in the interview she was giving, she was kind of like, you know, I'm putting this record out, then I'm going to go have my baby and chill and kind of peace out of the rat race for a while and not be on this hamster wheel that she's been on for most of her career. So it was kind of presented with, I don't want to say a shrug, but kind of her saying, this is not the only thing going on in my life right now. This is not my primary, music is not necessarily like my primary reason for living right now. She's getting married, she's focusing on family, and in some ways that record like addresses that a little bit too.
I mean, I think it'll be very interesting to see what the post baby, the first motherhood record will be for Katy. I mean, I do hope she makes another record. I'm fairly certain she will. It will not be A Ray of Light, which is one of my favorite post motherhood albums.
Never say never.
Outside of Smile, I wasn't like crazy about the singles from Smile. And your review actually said that you felt like they perhaps had gotten short shrift in revisiting them in the context of the album. You thought that they were better. I totally agree with that. I think Never Really Over is actually a pretty solid song. I tell myself, draw the line. Not do I do, but once in a while I trip up and across the line. I'm not crazy about Harleys in Hawaii, even though that was co-written by John Caramonica favorite Charlie Puth. You're not going to listen to that one. I'm sort of partial to Cry About It Later. Did you prefer that or Teary Eyes? As you point out in your review, there are two songs about crying back to back on the album, which might be a lot.
just thematically really driving the crying home. I preferred Teary Eyes, but I don't really like either of those songs, I must say.
You don't like either of them.
That feels very stuck in the Witness era to me. Like, those songs both kind of feel like they could have been leftovers from the Witness sessions.
You know, I'm not going to disagree with you. There were elements of Witness that I liked, and I think this is the string of that that I enjoyed. All right, so we don't have to listen to Cry About It Later. I'm not sure how I feel about listening to Teary Eyes. If we were going to listen to one more Smile song before we went out, what would you choose, Lindsay?
I think we should play a little bit of Daisies in honor of Daisy Bloom, and also in the question it brings up of, like, at what point did Katy Perry know that she was going to name her child Daisy? Because the internet was kind of onto that before, you know, she released a song called Daisies. There were a lot of people being like, oh my God, if she names her child Daisy, it's Daisy Bloom. And then she went and did it.
Oh, okay. I never really put that together. Yeah, yeah.
I'm not saying it was like a marketing strategy, but, you know, that she now has a song and a child named after daisies. And I think this song is pretty good. I think there's the chorus vocal. I think it's sort of reaching back to referencing, you know, the firework era of just the songs about underdogs, and Katy Perry is kind of championing the underdog, which in a way feels more authentic now because she kind of has become this pop underdog. But Firework is a superior song. I find those tracks on this record to be kind of interesting. And this one in particular is, there's something really wild and manic about the vocal in the chorus where she's really just like screaming the word daisies again and really like letting it rip in this kind of, again, almost Alanis Morissette rock vibe. And it feels a little bit in excess of what the song calls for, but there's a passion and an energy to the vocal that I find surprising and over the top in kind of a good way for her.
What you were describing is really what I like best about my favorite Lady Gaga songs, to be honest with you. You know, like, we didn't say this at the top of the podcast, but obviously it goes without saying, they're both exceptional musicians with, you know, really powerful, really excellent voices that do not need to be auto-tuned or anything. They're both excellent live performers. But yeah, some of what I like best about Gaga is the stuff where she was in her sort of arena rock phase, particularly on Born This Way. And I do get that from that. But you're just describing about this moment in Daisies. I get that. And as we go out on Daisies, I'm actually reminded of a story from my... This is a real Katy Perry Witness moment, because I'm going to tell you a story about me. let's make this about me for a second. Yes. So about when
you
were
the witness.
When I was writing that story about her, and we were talking about when she was at election night, when she was at the Javits Center, sort of awaiting what she was anticipating to be Hillary Clinton's victory, which obviously was not, and that she was, you know, sort of losing her mind. And Lady Gaga was there too. And they kind of just like held hands because they needed to touch each other. And they just like needed a moment of stability at this moment where we cannot touch each other, where we were talking about Katy Perry and Lady Gaga and heading into another election. I actually was really sort of imagining that moment the other day and how powerful it must have been. So let's go out on Daisies and think about the relationship between Lady Gaga, Katy Perry, and, for the heck of it, Taylor Swift, because I think that Folklore is a big part of this conversation too.
What a beautiful image to end on.
I have to say, I was really moved by that. I am endeared to both of these artists, and there is something that does keep pulling me back. And it is very easy. We're talking about this a lot on the podcast, but like, it's so easy for the internet to just tear people apart and not really be paying attention to the music. There's so much about these artists' narratives that are larger, you know, larger than life, larger than the music, but they are fundamentally two extremely gifted musicians. And, you know, it's nice to return to that for a minute.
It does feel like this moment where female artists are more coming together in this fundamental way than kind of, you know, there was a lot of pitting women against each other in the whole history of pop culture that I think we're finally getting to a slightly more complicated understanding. I think the success of songs like Rain on Me and even something like WAP or the Savage Remix this summer, like there's a lot of women who the culture may have pitted against each other before who are holding hands, so to speak, and kind of sidestepping that narrative.
I think it's because the fans have a new enemy that they can all agree on, which is music critics.
Yeah, boomers. Boomers like us.
I'm fine with that if it means that there's harmony in pop music. People can continue to hate me for my folklore take.
There you go.
Which I do like it a little bit better than I did when the album came out, but I'm not fully giving it. Okay. On that note, thank you, podcast listeners, for letting me fill in for John this week. I have been Karen Gans. This is Lindsay Zolads. You can get the podcast anywhere you get your audio. And if you would like to reach us directly with feedback, it is podcast@nytimes.com. Our producer is Pedro Rosado of Headstepper Media, and we will see you next week. They tell me that I'm crazy, but I'll never let them change me. So they cover me in daisies, daisies, daisies. They said I'm going nowhere, try to get me out. Took those sticks and stones, showed them I could build a house. They tell me that I'm crazy, but I'll never let them change me. So they cover me in daisies.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.